Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current status of my Sunday sermon. Art society has a very interesting relationship with demonic possession. It's a continual topic of Hollywood movies, all the way back to The Exorcist, which was a really big movie back in the 70s, and Hollywood won't let it go. But yet secularism says that we only allow agents with flesh on them. These are the only persons that we imagine or talk to, and that's sort of the public persona. But then privately, people have all kinds of strange ideas, and those strange ideas flourish sort of beneath the surface. But we sort of play this two-stage game. Christians, of course, assert a huge backstory behind the natural world, and a lot of this comes from Augustine, where there's and the Bible, where there's angels and demons and on, and so demonic possession is something that we sort of get fascinated by. But so here you and your secular neighbor get a little stuck when talking to Christians, because Christians talk this way, and you're like, well, you know, all this, these crazy stories out of the Bible, that was all mental health and psychology and stuff. And well, maybe, but let's play around with this a little bit. Let me get my things working. Okay, so we have this story in Mark 5. So they came to the other side of the lake, and if you saw my sermon last week, it was about Jesus stilling the storm. They came to the other side of the lake, to the region of the Gerasenes. Just as Jesus was getting out of the boat, a man with an unclean spirit came from the tombs and met him. Sounds like something right out of a horror film. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. Now, it's quite likely that this man grew up and had family and friends in that community nearby. Everybody knew him. They didn't kill him because he's their friend, but they couldn't do anything with him. This sort of reminds me of a situation when I lived in the Dominican Republic. We had some friends who lived in town. We were a little bit outside of town where my wife and I and kids lived, but we had some friends who were right in town, and they had this beautiful balcony where we'd enjoy dinners together, and every now and then you just hear somebody just screaming at the top of his lungs. And we're like, what's that? And one of my friends said, well, that's the screamy guy. I said, well, what's his story? Well, he was someone with mental illness in this little town where we lived in the Dominican Republic, and about the only way the family could deal with him is to pretty much lock him in a room. And that was his life. And you almost get the sense from this story that this is probably someone who grew up in the town, and, you know, he was just too crazy. They couldn't deal with it. And so he lived out amongst the tombs. If you want to read some interesting stuff, read Scott Alexander and some of the stuff he's written on schizophrenia and immigration and some of this stuff. Scott Alexander is a very interesting blogger. Anyway, my ADHD took over right in the middle of reading the Bible. For his hands and feet had often been bound with chains and shackles, but he had torn the chains apart and broke the shackles in pieces. See, well, that sounds supernatural. That gets to this level of, you know, we often, if you meet some people who have mental illness and they're just out of their mind, they seem to have super strength, partly because they have no inhibitions, and they just, you know, their bodies are completely marshaled to do the strongest things. And this is all talk about people lifting cars when they, you know, when they have to save the life of their child or something. Human beings are amazing. So this guy, you know, for a schizophrenic, and I've dealt with a lot of schizophrenics over here on the corner of Florin Road. I mean, the reality they're living in the midst is just as real as the reality that you and I have, except it's in many cases a whole lot more terrifying. No one was strong enough to subdue him. And so there he's living amongst the tombs. Probably the tombs were in caves on the side of the Sea of Galilee. And everybody knew about him. Each night and every day among the tombs and in the mountains, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. There used to be a schizophrenic who would live in Chorley Park, which is not far from my house. And his name was Gordon. And he was schizophrenic, and he sort of lived in the park. He would hide out from the rangers. That part of the park by my house is sort of undeveloped. And you just hear him screaming at night back there. There was another woman who, she was a schizophrenic, and she was homeless, and she was living by the church. And And she'd be, this is when we didn't have a child care center here, and she would just be on the back lot. She'd just be screaming at people. She'd be yelling at people. And one day she got a hold of my phone number, and she would leave me voicemail messages telling me that she knows what I've done, and she heard it on the radio, and how I'm holding her family in the Livingstones dungeon. I kept that voicemail because it was so amazing. And so I'm holding your family in the Livingstones dungeon, which is hilarious because if you're in this part of Northern California, you know that there's hardly any basements around. There's no basement in the church. Everything's on these cement slabs, but I'm holding her family in the church's torture chamber underneath. It's like, okay. So when I read this passage, I certainly think of schizophrenics that I've known. And so Gordon living out in the park, he'll be horrified to know what he had. Gordon living out in the park, yelling and screaming all night long at who knows what. He's made his living by trimming trees. And so he was incredibly strong. I mean, I used to shake his hand and his arms were like trees. And that's because he's holding chainsaws all day and trimming people's trees. Eventually, one day he was trimming some trees and he fell out of a tree and broke his hips. And the neighbors decided, well, they were going to help Gordon. So they visited him in the hospital. And the first few days was all cool because everyone's like, oh, you know, this is great. You know, three square meals, blah, blah, blah. But about 5 days into it, Jordan starts basically verbally attacking the neighbors. And I just watched all this happen because I've dealt with schizophrenics a lot. And it's kind of like, yeah, you think you can help him? Nah, it's not going to happen. Schizophrenia is a terrible, incredibly disturbing illness. And so when I read this, I think of, I don't know how many schizophrenics that I've known. And so we seculars say, ah, yeah, see, it was schizophrenia. And Mark Twain, the difference between a miracle and a fact is exactly the difference between a mermaid and a seal, says Mark Twain. Sounds like schizophrenia. They can be strong, like Gordon in the park. He was incredibly strong. He'd be screaming all night. Now, they didn't want to kill him, probably, because he was a member of the community. He was somebody's son and somebody's brother. And you know, usually with schizophrenia, it starts happening, you know, early 20s, late teens, early 20s. And I've got so many stories about schizophrenics. You know, the cutting, the self-torture, on and on and on and on. The story doesn't sound made up. The story sounds very real. And many with schizophrenia can enter normal society with medication today. But of course, there's none of that medication back in at this period of time. And you can't talk a schizophrenic out of their mental illness. And I spent a lot of time talking to schizophrenics. And I usually find it rather interesting because it's sort of sometimes like random word association. And they'll be, if you talk to them long enough, you begin to piece their stories together. If you listen to my Sunday school class, sometimes you'll note that Louis comes to Sunday school. And Louis, I don't know his diagnosis, but there's certainly some schizophrenia going on there. And Louis just, you know, random word association all throughout my Sunday school class. And Louis, you got to kind of tone it down and on. And Louis comes every now and then for a few weeks, and he disappears for a few months. But in a little while, the story's going to take a strange turn because I've known a lot of schizophrenics, but I've never seen it jump to a group of pigs. And again, that's just a made-up story. Well, it was so funny because the day I started working on the story, Job on the Discord server says, I can't even go to a large structure fire without having to catch a loads of convo. Conversations, I think he's talking about on the Discord server, which has been really hot. 1,500 pigs died. And a little bit later, Job wrote about that. Job's a fireman in his little Dutch village. And it was like, what are the odds that he posts this on the Discord server at the exact same moment I'm working on my sermon about all the death of pigs? Mark Twain also said, it's no wonder that truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction has to make sense. Last week we looked at Shakespeare's quote about tale told by an idiot of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Now let's slow down and look at a couple of interesting things here. Notice he's a man with an unclean spirit. And notice how the guy runs up to meet Jesus. Now this unclean spirit suddenly, unclean. Now we're reaching back to the Mosaic law. And what's interesting about this law is a lot of people take shots at trying to figure out, well, why is this, is it about, did they not eat pork because of sanitation and on, but most of the best Old Testament scholars notice that the patterns in the Mosaic law have everything to do with order and chaos and the shape of an ordered life. And that's why certain animals with certain combinations, like shellfish, are not allowed to eat shellfish. Why? Because they're living in the sea. They should have fins and swim. They shouldn't have shells and walk along the ground. Now you might say, well, what difference does that make? But it's a certain mode of thinking about order and chaos. It's a certain symbolic world that they're living in. Now one of the things is that a lot of the contemporary translations sort of mess this up. The Lexham English Bible, which I use, it comes with my Bible software sometimes. You know, they at least put unclean in the NET that I'm using for this sermon. They put unclean in, and that's the best word. That's actually the better rendering of the Greek, but many audiences don't understand it. So the NIV, I think, actually confuses things even more by saying impure. I don't know what frame of reference. I shouldn't use sermon time to complain about modern Bible translations, but here I am. Impure, I'm not quite sure where that leads modern thinkers. And the New Living Translation, which is not a translation at all, it's a paraphrase, evil spirit. Well, that I think leads us in the completely wrong direction. But I can understand why they use it. And this gets into this question of how do we think about the demonic? How do we regard it? How do we make sense of it in the context of this passage? But now look at the data. You have a historic religious description. You have a person who seems irrational, and I've been doing a lot of thinking about that. Maybe I'll do a word that fudges on irrational. It's chaotic, it's violent and exceptionally strong. He's self-destructive. He's living among the tombs, which is both deeply symbolic and deeply saying. And then he runs to Jesus. What's this? How can we get a sense of what's going on in this man that neither just plops us in the middle of the modernist fundamentalist view, nor takes a rather dismissive modern mental health frame and imposes it on the passage? When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him. Now that's really strange. And that should really scramble your frames. Then he cried out with a loud voice, "Leave me alone, Jesus, Son of the Most High God." Maybe the spirit world is not as archaic, obtuse, or simple as we imagined it is. "I implore you by God." You've got a demon using God's name to implore Jesus. "Do not torment me." Now, this is really interesting. For Jesus has had to come out of that man, you unclean spirit. Now I don't have time to go into all of the very interesting ways these things connect in terms of New Testament language about demons. And the Old Testament really has very, very little of that, which is a very interesting thing. But it gets deeply tied to the Mosaic covenant and the clean and unclean, the matrix that God gives Israel to bring order to their life in the middle of the ancient Near East cultures. It's very interesting how these things are playing together. And there are resonances here between the order that Israel needs via the Mosaic law and the lack of order in this man's life. And the knowledge that he seems to have that Jesus is the source. I mean, this is in a sense John 1, that Jesus is the source of bringing logos, of bringing order to the chaos that has destroyed his family, destroyed his life, and is leading him to live and scream out and cut himself in the middle of the night. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." That is so telling. He begged Jesus repeatedly not to send them out of the region. What's going on? What do you mean them? How can they? I'm thinking about, I can't say this in the sermon because nobody in my church knows who Jonathan Peugeot is. They can't inhabit garments of skin, as it were. There on the hillside, a great herd of pigs were feeding. This gives us a little bit of background in terms of what kind of community Jesus is in. This is a Gentile community because Jews didn't keep pigs, not observant Jews. And so this man likely wasn't a Jew at all. And he comes from a town that isn't full of Jews. And there's a herd of pigs. Send us into the pigs. Let us enter them. Jesus gave them permission. Why is Jesus giving quarter to a legion of demons? This is so bizarre on so many levels. So the unclean spirit, again, that's a key word here, and that should really, in terms of the Bible, that should really guide our thinking in this. Came out, and they went into the pigs. And the herd rushed down a steep slope into the lake, and about 2,000 were drowned in the lake. Now, we have a saying about horse sense, but we could probably give it to pigs as least as much. Pigs are one of the smartest animals we know. They're at least as smart as your dog. And some people say that pigs are sort of man acostado, man on all fours. Pigs are really smart. And pigs don't just run into the lake and drown. And a whole herd of pigs doesn't run into the lake and drown. And they wouldn't be grazing these pigs by the edge of the water if these people who have known pigs for generations, who know how to keep pigs, had no fear that the pigs would do this. Yet all of this gets connected. And again, what is going on in this story? Oh, they just made this story up. Really? This isn't even the kind of story one would make up. So a secular reading says the difference between a miracle and a fact is exactly the difference between a mermaid and a seal. Well, this didn't happen. Why not? Schizophrenics aren't talked out of their mental illness. It's a chemical thing. Well, the story before, he stilled a storm. That's a physics thing. That's a meteorological thing. He's been healing people all over the place. Pigs don't drown themselves. Why does the story exist at all? I think the most reasonable assumption is it happened. Now, you might be hard-pressed to explain it, but to just dismiss it because it's old? Or do you dismiss it because it makes you feel better? Or do you struggle to make sense of it? Well, that's actually the same Mark Twain's definition of probably something that's more likely to be true. Now, if you read sermons all the way back to church fathers, everyone struggles with this over all the same issues we do. Why would Jesus give the demons quarter? Why even, you know, whether you're bringing it with the church frame, with this large backstory of demons and all of that, or you're bringing with the schizophrenic, modern, therapeutic, secular, scientific frame, the story just keeps breaking out of the frames. And so maybe if we want to make sense of the story, we should actually use the frame that it's in and take this unclean idea, this disordered idea, and say, well, maybe that will help us out understanding the story. Now, what is a person? I've done a lot of thinking about this over the last couple of years. It's someone or something with agency. And if you look at my talk with Vervaeke that I did, you know, I'm doing a lot of thinking about persons. And it's someone with identity. And all of these things cohere. It's someone who can relate to others. And quite clearly, schizophrenia just completely destroys that. So I'm going to have to show restraint here because I have so many schizophrenic stories and some of them are so tragic and some of them are even comic, but they're just schizophrenic or just, they're just story makers all over the place because they're just living in a different world. And it's a world we can kind of understand, but mostly not. Who was, A Beautiful Mind, that movie and that novel on that schizophrenic. And you know, someone who can relate to others. They can act within a community rationally. And what I mean by rationally here is it's basically on the same page as everybody else. He says, we are legion. Now, we are all legion. We're all these jumbles of conflicting desires. And I forgot to turn the phone off. We are all these jumbles of conflicting desires and emotions and stories and actually, we are all legion, and what what we want to do, we don't do. We can't resist that thing of chocolate ice cream. We can't go to the gym every day and get our exercise. We're not the kind of person, we're not the kind of things that Steven Pinker thinks we are. I listen. So I'm not going to talk about Steven Pinker on Sunday, but you know, I listen to him and I think, have you met people? Do you spend time with them? Do you know what we're like? We're a mess. We're legion. We're all over the map. And schizophrenics are just kind of a really extreme variant of what we are. And we change over time. The person I am now is not the same person I was when I was 20 or 30 or 40 or even 50 in some ways. And because our context changes. And so we're different people over here with this group, and we go to another country and we speak a different language, and we're that people over there. We are many. So these are some friends of mine, and that little boy with the big afro, he's a grown man now, living in a different part of the country, doing really well. But this is one of my best friends. And I'm not going to name his name just because I'm on YouTube, but one of the nicest compliments he ever paid about his wife, which is very, very true, because everybody, I'm going to use this in church and everybody's going to know it's true because everyone just deeply respects this woman. She's the same person everywhere she goes. He told me that years ago, and it stuck in my mind because that's who and how she is. She's rock solid. She's put together. She's integrated. She's unruffable. She's the same person everywhere she goes. She is not legion. She is one. Now the herdsmen ran off and spread the news in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the one who had the legion. And they were afraid. Remember in the last story, when Jesus stilled the storm, and the disciples are afraid? They're both afraid for the same reason. The crazy man, the demon-possessed man, the man with an unclean spirit, the schizophrenic, they all get that. But what happened? That's just terrifying. That's the kind of thing that you wouldn't want to see way more than a scary movie about an exorcist. That's troubling. Who is this man who is doing this? Those who had seen what had happened to the demon-possessed man reported it, and they also told about the pigs. And they asked Jesus to leave the region. Yeah! Ask nicely, I bet, but... And Jesus does. He doesn't say, ha, 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 I'm here now. I'm a god. Bow before me. He's humble and kind and, okay, I'll leave. But there's another interchange to come. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed asked if he could go with him. But Jesus did not permit him to do so. Well, why not? Should this be like someone Jesus dangles from his wrist as, oh, look what I can do? You'll notice that that's not who Jesus is at all. Go to your home and to your people and tell them what the Lord has done for you, that he had mercy on you. So he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis. That was an area of 10 cities, Decapolis, 10 cities, what Jesus had done for him, and all were amazed. Well, why would Jesus do this? Well, this is part of the reason Jesus always said, be a little quiet about the miracles, okay? Because it sends people in the wrong direction. This person's testimony is, in a sense, less distractible than Jesus in some ways, because he can testify what God has done for him. And this is actually now the Decapolis. These are Gentile communities. He is, in some ways, Jesus, one of Jesus' early apostles to the Gentiles. He didn't even know about the crucifixion and the resurrection yet. That hadn't happened. And Jesus just went over to the other side of the lake, created an apostle, and sent him out. And who knows the effect that had amongst those people. Now what's going on? You have this unclean, you have this legion, you have the symptoms, you have the strange behavior amongst what should have been very reasonable pigs. And the word, a seed from two stories ago, gets thrown out amongst the rocky soil and the hard stuff and the shallow soil. But the plow had already gone through this man's life, and Jesus is bearing fruit through him. Truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction has to make sense. This is, we don't know what to make of this. Now, we too are legion. All the identity issues, gotta keep my eye on the time. All the identity issues, all of the social issues. We long to be formed into a cohesive whole. We long to be masters of our own houses. We long to be well put together. We long to be the same person, whatever the situation, whatever the circumstance. The Apostle Paul says, I've learned to be content in all circumstances. We long for this. This is something that Jesus is developing in us, and he's doing it through all of this chaos and all of this tragedy, through the plow that goes through on whatever kind of soil and situation we are. This is what Jesus is doing. The whole has more agency. It's not cast about. The whole has more consistency. This is people we wish to become. Well, how does this happen? Well, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning? Well, what is sinning? It's missing the mark. It's missing the mark all over the place. So we go on sinning that grace may increase? By no means. We are those who have died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? Well, now we get into this kind of dual way that the Apostle Paul talks. Or don't you know that all of us were baptized into Christ Jesus, were baptized into his death? In a certain way, that man died, and another one was reborn, and that transformation was dramatic to everyone who knew him or knew about him. One of the things you realize in a walking neighborhood is that everybody knows the crazies. Everybody knows the street people, at least those who are also walking and not hopping in their cars and zipping through, who just see them at the street corners or hear them in the middle of the night screaming in the park. We were therefore buried with him through baptism, the ceremonial drowning. The ceremonial, it's drowning and it's cleansing, because our sin death dies. But Adam is a strong swimmer. Buried with him through baptism into death, in order that just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may live a new life. This starts now. It comes to full flourishing in the consummation of our resurrection. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. For we know that our old self was crucified with him, so that the body ruled by sin might be done away with. Individual body, unformed body, corporate body, all of these bodies. That we should no longer be slaves to sin, as he was slaves to the demons, to the unclean spirit. Any way you want to describe it. Because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. This is Paul, in a sense, telling the story in a different way. Now, a tiny man, tiny part of the man runs to Jesus. That's all you need. It's not your coming to him that rescues you. It's his power to remake you, to bring you together, to make you into a person. Legion must go and die. Union must come. The man must stay with his people, and he becomes a living witness to the Father. Notice how selfless Jesus is. Go tell everyone what God has done for you, what the Lord has done for you. Jesus have liked him to be nearby? I'm sure he would. This was for the man's sake, for the kingdom's sake. Jesus knows that, in a strange way, this man is the perfect witness to the Decapolis, in a way that even Jesus, wouldn't be. Strange, isn't it? We are reborn not for ourselves, but for our neighbors, the one who owns the unclean pigs, the ones who ask Jesus to leave. So which world is stranger? Which world do you really believe?